Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Spinning the Reel. I'm your host, Evan.
And I'm your host, Zach.
And we are very excited for this episode because we get to talk about some good movies.
Yeah, absolutely. Some freaking fantastic movies.
Yes. I feel like it's such a rare opportunity these days because, you know, we had the summer of Barbenheimer. And then there was kind of, I feel like, a little bit of a dry stretch kind of since then where things have
settled down a little bit
here and there. But now are the big ones. We're getting into the fall, award season, all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, when the studios and stuff save their big movies for. So this week we're talking about Killers of the Flower Moon, the new Scorsese picture. And then what's our other one?
We're talking Anatomy of a Fall. Which is a French movie. I think it was Palme d'Or at Cannes.
It was,
yep. Very prestigious award. We saw this at an unlimited screening recently. Excited to talk about that one.
Awesome. So two really big, impactful movies that I think people are going to be talking about a lot for the rest of the year and should show up on a lot of end-of-the-year lists. So we're excited to get to it. All right, Zach, let's start with the big one. And no, I don't mean the Eras Tour. Neither of us have been fortunate enough to go, but...
I did get my cup and bucket.
Did you really?
Yes.
Did you pay full price for it?
Yeah, of course.
Got to put that money in Taylor's pocket. But we're going to actually not talk about Taylor Swift. We're going to talk about the only man who stood up to her domination of the box office. Martin Scorsese. He is Killers of the Flower Moon is really like the only big movie that didn't run away from the Eras Tour.
I mean, it waited until the week after it,
but it was always,
or 2 weeks after.
I think it was always scheduled for that weekend though, right? Like
probably
when it came out.
Yeah,
but I know like Dumb Money moved a couple weeks up, and I think a couple movies moved like later because as soon as Taylor Swift announced she was gonna release this concert film, everyone's like, nope, we want to make money on our opening
weekend.
Yeah,
definitely the smart move.
So anyway, not really the point. There's a lot to be said about Killers of the Flower Moon. Do you want to describe what it is?
Yeah, of course. So Killers of the Flower Moon is, as you mentioned, Martin Scorsese's latest feature film. It is about a sort of dark time in our history. And it's adapted from a historical nonfiction book about a indigenous tribe of Native Americans, the Osage, who were forced from their homes and relocated to Oklahoma, but kind of discovered oil there. And so instantly became very rich overnight. And of course, this was attractive to people who wanted to steal that wealth from them. Which is where our story comes in of Ernest and Bill, or William Hale, right? I think is his last name.
Yeah, it's Ernest Burkhart.
Yeah, Burkhart.
And Bill Hale or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who conspire to have Ernest marry an Osage woman and murder her family so that he can inherit her oil rights.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is not... This isn't the only case in which it's happening. This is sort of a systemic thing in Osage County in Oklahoma. That's what the story is. And there's a lot of awful, awful stuff that happens.
I was going to say, if that sounds bleak, then, you know, it is. It very much is a bleak picture of a very dark time in U.S. history. So that period to the Osage is known as the Reign of Terror when this kind of thing was happening. So like you said, Leonardo DiCaprio plays Ernest Burkhart, and he marries Molly is his wife's name, or his to-be wife, played by Lily Gladstone. And yeah, it's this weird kind of almost warped love story because it's sort of portrayed in a way that like, there's some sort of conflict going on within Ernest, but he's just like a really skeezy
guy. I think there's that video of one of the Osage like consultants. I think he was a language consultant.
Right.
I don't remember his name on Twitter.
It's Christopher Cote.
That's right. Yeah, he's talking about his perspective after the premiere and stuff. And I think he puts it pretty eloquently that, and this was my takeaway as well, having watched the movie, is that I don't really see any love in this movie
right.
at all.
Yeah.
And I find it odd that people talk about it that way, in the sense that, like, yes, he is portrayed as sort of this conflicted person,
right?
But not really, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of something that his love is for money first and foremost, and like,
I don't think so. Like,
it's explicitly that though throughout the movie, and we can get into it. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's something we can touch on in a moment, but. Like, in the sense that he is portrayed as sort of conflicted, but I think it's just something that he sort of tells himself in a way, sure, to justify what he's doing, in that he, like, you know, he takes care of her and he makes sacrifices for her. And right. In some instances, he does allow her to have, or I say allow, but like, right, she exhibits agency in you know, and takes actions that he doesn't get in her way for, or just kind of throws, sure, his hands up at. And so I definitely do not see any sort of like love in, right, in it. To me, it's not a love story at all. And
but it's almost built that way, is I guess maybe what I mean. Like, in the film, it's sort of,
it gives it that structure in the, right, beginning. Like, yes, when they meet and he's her cab driver and they're kind of like flirting a little bit. But then it's revealed almost instantly that she does not take him seriously. Like, right, he's a himbo, and she,
yeah, that is true. I think, like, that's kind of the thing, like, and that was another thing that, Cote said in that, that interview, kind of review, his thoughts about the film, that he consulted on as well, is that, like, Martin Scorsese did the best he could to represent the Osage people, but he is not an Osage person, and of course neither of us are either, so everything with a grain of salt to that degree. But, you know, he told the story that he's capable of telling, and that is of, because this is really, it's a Scorsese movie, you know. If you've seen Goodfellas, if you've seen The Wolf of Wall Street, if you've seen a lot of his, like, crime drama kind of movies, it is about, like, you know, somebody who works, in this case it really not works, but, you know, like, builds up from,
it's a kind of working, like you know, conning and manipulating,
exactly, all the way to the top before it all comes crumbling down, mm-hmm, for him, and then we can talk about how it kind of cleverly restructures that and tears down even that idea of that being what the movie is trying to say or be about with the way it ends. But it is all told from the perspective of Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Ernest. And I think you're right. In his head, it is like, maybe he is telling himself that this is a, like, a romancing, and then he is taking care of his family and, like, the way that his uncle is telling him to. And so maybe that's where the framing comes from, not to get too bogged down in it. But
something just occurred to me, and I kind of want to talk about how this does end.
Yeah.
So the rest of the story is, you know, he meets Molly and they do sort of fall in love, you could say, and then him and his uncle enact their plans, in which the deaths of her family member occur,
right,
either through natural causes because they're kind of ill on their own,
not being treated,
yeah, or, you know, through murder. And they're so greedy and transparent in their greed, and bold, you know. Yeah. One of her sisters is literally killed in a domestic terrorism incident with dynamite.
Yeah.
That it attracts the attention of the federal government after significant pleading for help from the Osage people. So, you know, and that's the other half of this is what the book is about, is like the creation of the FBI, and this being one of their first, if not the first, cases that they worked.
Yeah, I think it was the first, like, murder convictions that they mm-hmm. successfully
so yeah, that's how the story does end. They are you know, captured and tried and found guilty for this murderous conspiracy that they're involved in. But I want to come back to Scorsese's, like, interest in these types of characters, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of characters that he's shown on screen, you know, that are damaged, or, like, I guess, you know, manipulative, like, they're, sure, they're bad people, narcissists and criminals.
And a lot of times getting kind of roped into things too. If you look at, like, Goodfellas or, like, even The Irishman or something, this is Wolf of Wall Street, sort of, I guess, because Matthew McConaughey's character kind of recruits in
He tells him to like dream bigger, but by that point he's already a criminal. Like that's after he's doing stocks, the crime. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. So, but anyway, like a lot of it is like a simple person that's brought into and then becomes a big part of these conspiracies. And that's not to excuse any of the behavior of like Ernest or anything, but it is.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was leading to is that these characters that he likes to explore and put the stories on screen and put these you know, sometimes despicable or broken or even manipulated themselves kind of people front and center is a lot of the time you think of it as like portrayal as endorsement, you know, a lot of people take it that way or they identify with the character. And so then
certainly happened a lot with Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the number one example right now is like, you know, some people idolize Jordan Belfort and think like he's amazing and like a smart person or whatever. Right. I think that this one in particular is one that it would be really
unmistakable.
Someone would have to be going out of their way or like extremely willfully ignorant to think that Ernest Burkhart, Leonardo DiCaprio's character in this movie, or Robert De Niro's as well, are the good guy in any way, you know, or have done anything right here. Like they are inextricably the villains of this movie,
right?
And there's a line in the film as well, you know, one of my favorite moments, and it's a really small moment, but it really sticks with you. And it's just, you know, can you see the wolves in this picture when he's reading about
the Osage.
History of the Osage? Yeah. Yeah. And then of course, you know, in perfect filmic language, he narrates that to himself. He reads that line in the book and then the camera points to his brother walking in.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's so good. And there's a lot of little examples like that of the camera, you know, a line reading and then who the camera cuts to, you know, either Robert De Niro or Leonardo DiCaprio or Byron in this case.
Right. Yeah, that is true. That is a really good moment in the film and sort of it tees up exactly what you're saying. And like you said, it's unmistakable in a way that, like, again, The Wolf of Wall Street, I still think is pretty clear and obvious what that movie is trying to say. But you can understand why someone would see, like, you know, he's out there with Margot Robbie and he's, you know, doing all this crazy shit in like an office and they're doing all these drugs and you can see why someone might view it as an endorsement, but, you know, they would have to not think about it very hard. But from the very first moment that you see Ernest in this movie, he shows up and gives this like wry little Leonardo DiCaprio smile, then his teeth are just like all fucked up and you're just like it's just you know, maybe some of it's historical accuracy or whatever, but they go a long way to portray him as pretty sinister and pathetic both at the same time, like throughout the movie, and I think that's done really well. And the same thing with Robert De Niro's character is just cartoonishly evil, you know, with these schemes that he comes off with, like it's pretty unmistakable, but it is, I think, an interesting kind of representation of American imperialism and even within the United States, that a lot of times what was happening is, you know, people were like white people were coming in pretending to be friends to these native populations and saying like, oh, I'm doing these things for you and I'm here to help you and I'm your friend, all at the same time while literally scheming behind their backs to steal their land, steal their resources, steal all these things.
That's literally the history of the Americas. Like,
of course.
Up and down the continent.
Yeah.
Both North and South America, like, you know, the conquistadors and and just the way that these lands were taken is exactly that. Like,
And then just as cartoonish as he might be, that is a really potent, like, I don't know, metaphor for just the whole experience, you know, like that kind of like, oh, I'm your friend. Well, he's literally taking everything from these people. And, you know, even towards the end of the movie, when they're kind of talking about what happens to all the characters, and for him, like to his last breath, he was basically saying that I did right by all these people that I murdered and all of these things. And it's just really eye-opening to see the way that people delude themselves. And that's part of this movie too, is, you know,
well, I mean, that's like, that's because he's racist, right? Like, he views them as you know, as a simple people who are, who happen to get lucky mm-hmm. that their land had oil on it, and that, you know, the sort of like manifest destiny kind of right. attitude that this is actually, this belongs to me. You're just in my way.
Right.
And it's never enough. You know, it is never portrayed as wanting for anything except mm-hmm. more wealth.
Right.
From people he views as unworthy of it, or.
Yeah. Molly even says something when she's talking to her sisters, like, oh, he's not after my money. His uncle is Bill.
No, she's not the one that says that. It's her other sister.
Yeah. Okay.
It's either Minnie or Anna, but Molly is the one who says, like, one of her sisters is cautioning her, saying, like, he just wants your money.
Yeah.
And then she's like, yeah, of course he does. Like, right. yeah, everyone wants right. money. Like, you know, but he's not very smart, and he's so handsome.
Yeah.
And then the other sister's like, if he wanted money, like, he would go to his uncle. Right. He really loves you.
As rich as anyone here.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's good. It's now is probably as good a time as any to talk about, like, from the beginning is as good a time as any, because Lily Gladstone is amazing in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stunningly good, you know, such a quiet composure in the performance. Like in so many of the performances of this movie, specifically Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro and a handful of others, Brendan Fraser notably, very loud, very yeah, in your face.
There's some discourse happening about his cameo.
I
so
can
to
understand
speak.
It's yeah. it's wild to put it mildly, but Lily Gladstone is just such a like a driving force behind this movie that every time she's on screen that you're just sort of drawn into the presence
yeah.
that she brings, that this kind of like this knowing, and it's all communicated, not all but a lot of it is communicated non-verbally, and it's just such a towering performance. I don't know what you thought about her in this movie.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, you pretty much said it all. Like, she doesn't, you know, she doesn't speak very much. She's like very, very often, and is silent mm-hmm. and will emote with a simple like expression or body language even. And it implies such a depth and like a wisdom to her character.
Sure.
And it's funny because Robert De Niro's character mentions something about it too. Like that's just kind of like their Osage like demeanor in a sense mm-hmm. that, you know, they know that they're like a powerful people, you know, or that I can't remember exactly how he describes it, but they know themselves, and that they're comfortable in the sense that they'll right. let you kind of run your mouth, or yeah. you know, they'll let you show who you are to them, you mm-hmm. know, and then not even commenting on it or anything, but just let you, and they call it like some kind of bird talk or something like that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But yeah, and with specific regards to her performance, it is very, very commanding and impressive what she can do with so little, that I feel like, you know, your average performer would struggle to do with entire lines right. of dialogue.
It takes a lot of restraint, because, you know, I think the natural instinct is to go big, is to, you know, your character is angry and you want to show that, but having the restraint to know that you're putting that onto the screen without, you know, ranting and raving in the same way that, like, there's some stories that I guess, like, Leonardo DiCaprio was, like, improvising a lot yeah, on the set to the point that it was annoying the other yeah. cast members. But, yeah. You know, and that works in its own way, too, and we can talk about that as well. But, yeah, Lily Gladstone, to be able to do convey everything that she does with the composure that performance requires is very difficult and very impressive, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And I particularly like her final moments too, when mm-hmm. she's confronting him, and it's crazy like how much she actually loves him, you
right
know? And she's even willing to forgive everything that he's done if he's only honest with her, if he can just
truth.
Be honest,
yeah.
like that's all he has to do. And she says this in a metaphor, like we'll take your sins to the river basically and let them be washed away.
Right.
And she gives him the opportunity and she says, you know, okay, well, I have only one question. Like what was in the medicine that you were giving me? And
right.
then he says it was just insulin, which is a lie. It contains some kind of poison.
Yeah.
And maybe like arsenic or something. And she knows that,
and right, of course.
And so then she, you know, silently just gets up and walks out. and that's her final moments on screen, and it's incredible. It's really good.
Yeah, it's really a very impressive performance. I thought, going down some of the other ones, like I said, I thought De Niro was a little cartoonish, but like intentionally yeah. so, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the movie was asking of him. And DiCaprio is so interesting because I don't know, I just think like tracking from the beginning of his career when he was like the teenage heartthrob in like Titanic and Romeo and Juliet, all that stuff. And then he is just so willing to do these roles that make him look like a buffoon or make him look sinister. And I think he likes to seek out these performances because
yeah,
that's
gotta
they're
be,
more challenging.
Exactly,
I guess.
Yeah. It's got to be more challenging as a performer.
And he just does that. There's shades of, what's his name in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in this movie, of just like this like sad sack loser, basically.
It's yeah.
It's a good performance too, and mm-hmm. in a very, very sinister villainous role for him. But also just like, again, cartoon, not necessarily cartoonish for him, but definitely buffoonish. He looks like just an idiot through parts of this
was
movie.
Was that his last movie before this, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
No, I think Don't Look Up came out since then, right?
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Which is its own thing. But
yeah, he's kind of a loser in that one too. I'm trying to think of the last time like he played a good guy.
Yeah, it's been a while, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't even seen The Revenant, but he just is like in the woods, right? That's not a
yeah
necessarily.
I haven't seen that either, actually. I don't know why he's there. Probably yeah. like a fur trapper or something, you know?
Sure.
But yeah, I love the all of the supporting performances as well.
Yeah.
Especially the I think his name's Kelsey. Just a really villainous person, like a psychopath, actually, because he admits to having this plan to adopting Osage children that he...
Oh, my God, yeah. That's, like, so unsettling.
It really is, where he, you know, he admits to plotting child murder.
Yeah,
the
guy is literally like, it sounds to me like you're planning on killing your wife and then your children. And he's like, well, not if it's not legal, I won't do it. Like,
yeah, well, I think the woman's already dead because he went to Mexico at this point or something, and
right.
he would have been in more trouble if he didn't come back to get the kids.
Yeah,
and then yeah, he's essentially thinking about knocking them off to get their drilling rights because they're half blood Osage.
Yeah,
it's just yeah, so insane,
disgusting.
And the worst part about that is that according to the book, it was an actual conversation that happened from that person. They That's actually crazy. Said that. To their attorney.
That's insane. And that's something we talked about a little bit with De Niro's character as well earlier, is this idea of like, you know, the boldness and the brazenness that they acted with. And historically, that's accurate. And then in terms of this movie as well, just like the openness with which they were committing these atrocities against human people. And it just speaks to the way that specifically these people viewed Native Americans, but really how, you know, white people at large viewed Native Americans for much of American history as well. And like you said, this isn't just exclusive to the United States, but, you know, all across the Americas. But I think this movie really does a good job of showing just the, like, insidiousness of how these people viewed, like, Native people as subhuman. And like when the FBI comes in, they're like, it's not a big deal, we'll deal with it here because we're you know like they just thought whatever, it's we can do whatever we want, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they could get away with it at the time, and it took, you know, a lot for this to stop. This happened over many years and all that, you know.
Yeah,
like,
I think it was over 30 Osage people dead, I want to say. Yeah, and very terrible, absolutely. Just repulsive.
Yeah. So obviously, like, speaking to the, you know, representation of Osage culture and all that, that's not really for us to say one way or another.
I thought what was depicted was pretty wonderful. And,
yeah,
you know, that's the final shot of the movie, is them in this, like, sort of celebration circle.
Yeah.
And it does go out of its way in the beginning, at least, to like mention some cultural touchstones.
Right, I really like the way those things were included, as well as like sort of a little mini history of the Osage people and mm-hmm. like how they got to be where they are and things like that. What I was gonna say is I did appreciate that, you know, in a very, very bleak movie with all of these murders that are happening, as far as I remember, every single Osage person that dies within the frame of the movie, and even some that happen before the events that are depicted there, are acknowledged on the screen. So Lily yeah. Gladstone's character is doing basically an acknowledgement of every Osage person that had died up to that point without investigation. And then they're like, everyone that does die as well, you get some familiarity with who that person is as a person.
Yeah.
You get an understanding of who they are and what they were like and that kind of thing. The characters that survive to the end of the, you know, the actual storytelling of the movie. This movie, I guess, I don't think it's really a spoiler to say that it's framed around like a radio broadcast show.
Yeah, I did want to talk about that too.
Yeah, which I thought was a very clever way of...
I love that ending.
...of ending the movie. And it sort of talks about what happens to each of the characters, you know, who goes to prison for how long, and, you know, what happens to the, you know, surviving members of the community that live on. And the very last, I think, spoken things on screen is Martin Scorsese himself coming up to the microphone and reading... what happened to Lily Gladstone's Molly,
yeah.
And like what became of her. So I did think that it was very respectful in terms of, you know, at least acknowledging that like all these atrocities happened, but like acknowledging the humanity behind, not trying to just sensationalize, you know, horrible, brutal murders for an entertainment product, but also just making sure that like these people were acknowledged as people first and foremost.
Yeah. So that, just to be clear, the end, there's a moment where it cuts from, I think it's the moment after she walks out of the room.
I think so too.
It cuts to, like you're saying, like an old school like radio show,
mm-hmm.
like a true crime podcast, basically.
Right.
About the murders. And then, yes, Scorsese comes out to read Molly Brown's obituary,
mm-hmm.
because she remarried to a John Brown, I think. And it's a very nice little summation. And I think it's meant as like a good thing when he says this, but his final words are like her obituary, what the literal words of her obituary. And then he says, and there's no mention of the murders, which I think is like that she wasn't like reduced to,
right.
to that moment of her, like the worst time of her life, basically,
right?
Because she did live out the rest of her life, you know, for several more years, even struggling with diabetes, at a time where, you know, that was a lot more fatal than it is now.
Sure.
And then, yeah, of course, so there was no mention of the murders, and then cut to that celebratory circle I mentioned a little bit earlier, and then
right
credits.
to kind of frame it, I think you're right thinking about it from that perspective, because it is really framing this as like the Osage people lived on, and still their culture survives to this day, and the members of this tribe are still, you know, around. And that, to end it that way, I think is an encouraging, positive thing.
Yeah. I also, so what I wanted to say particularly about the show at the end, the, mm-hmm. the radio show, is that I think it's just commentary on kind of even what we're doing right now.
Right.
You know, we're not necessarily taking the story and editorializing it to make content, which I think is a what you could say, a criticism you could levy against like a true crime
right.
podcast or a show or something like that, where it's almost exploitative inherently,
sure.
or is very easy to be, you know, it's a very easy pitfall to fall into of exploitation there.
Mm-hmm.
But that also, that's a limited perspective that we can have, right? Is like, that's the only way that we can talk about it and engage with it is almost like from this arm's length, like,
right.
And him sort of saying that he's aware of that perspective, and like, that's what,
mm-hmm.
that what his own movie, this movie minus that scene, might be looked at, but
right.
with that scene kind of not necessarily like, hangs a lampshade on it, but, is saying like, I'm aware that, you know, my perspective is limited, and his intention isn't to be disrespectful, right, or for this to be
further
sort of
exploiting people who are exploited.
Yeah, this or this to be viewed as like content, you know,
right,
which is something that has been spoken about in terms of like film, especially with the ongoing strikes and
right
and the studios referring to films, sure, and filmmakers as content creators.
God.
So bleak. Yeah, I like that ending, and I think it's for that reason.
Yeah, I think a lot of the choices that are made here, and again, it's Martin Scorsese, right? Of course, he's a master at this. He's been doing it forever, and is one of the great living filmmakers right now. And I think another one of the decisions that he makes in the conception of this film is to not frame it in the same way that the book is. So my understanding, having not read the book, just reading reviews of it here and there, is that a lot more of the book is framed around the actual creation of the FBI, mm-hmm, about the FBI coming in and sort of being the Western
heroes. Yeah,
like
the Marshall. Like
Jesse Plemons' character, which is always a joy when Jesse Plemons shows up in something, you know?
Absolutely.
You know you're in for a treat, but that his character coming in and sort of saving the day is the way the book is framed. And to sideline that, I guess, I wouldn't say it's completely, like, obviously the FBI does come in.
Right.
And, like, it,
I mean, it's how the murders are stopped.
It is
basically
how the murders are stopped, yes, because DiCaprio and De Niro's characters are detained and then eventually put in prison. But yeah, it is that, but it's not really framed around that. It actually is much more framed around like the bravery that Molly shows to go, you know, demand something be done about this in Washington. And it is not, I appreciate that it wasn't framed in the way of like the FBI, great job buddies.
I think there is a little bit of that, you know. There is some it's certainly a sympathetic portrayal of the FBI at this point in time.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, what, I don't even remember Jesse Plemons' character's name, but I'm curious as to what that person was actually like. Cause in my mind, you know, and he's not necessarily portrayed as like having a bleeding heart for these people that have been killed. Sure. He's more of just like,
this,
you know,
this is my job. I gotta.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's more about his respect for federal authority and like, that someone is breaking the law and that's offensive to him rather than who's being killed.
Yeah.
I
will say that there's a few too many J. Edgar Hoover name drops for it to be a truly sympathetic picture. Like, they want to make sure you're aware that, you know,
these are Hoover boys.
Exactly. The guys in charge here are not sympathetic characters still, you know?
Yeah. So. Well, this was before he was in office.
Of course.
Yeah. But yeah, it does. It lets you in kind of on their meetings of how they're investigating this and how they've actually like infiltrated the surrounding areas in Osage County. And they have an indigenous member as well, sort of posing as someone looking for lost family members to get information about who they think the killing, who's responsible for the killings. Which I love good procedurals. I think that's also like super interesting to watch, but
we're going to talk about one here in a
law enforcement needs a big asterisk in this story and in any story, really.
Right. I was going to say,
and, they do draw a parallel to the Tulsa race riots in this movie explicitly.
They actually explicitly use it as like, a counter almost like the I think De Niro's character actually uses it.
This is Tulsa all over again, which is
try and kind of turn the tide away from what they're doing. It's really
just terrible.
Yeah. Do we want to talk at all about the runtime? Like, I don't care about how long a movie is. And I think this movie flies by. I think the pace is, again, I will say that this is a very, very bleak movie, understandably so, given the subject material. Mm-hmm. I would, like, there's no world in which, like, the word fun is how you would describe, like, the content of this film.
Absolutely not.
But the pace is quick and it's snappy and there's no wasted moments
right
in it. And so it is a 3.5-hour movie, but it just zips by. At least that was my
Especially when experience. I think about The Irishman, for me at least, and maybe it's a part of the reason, or maybe the difference. Part of the difference is that The Irishman went onto Netflix, and you know, this went in. This is in theaters, but for me, The Irishman, I felt the runtime on.
I watched The Irishman in a theater, and it dragged at points. You know, that is a movie you feel the runtime of.
Yeah, this one absolutely not. I think I wrote in my review that it feels almost chapter like. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it is adapted from a book. And there feels like very clear, you know, like a very clear beginning, middle, and end.
You know what's funny is I think The Irishman is also adapted from a book and literally is divided into chapters.
I have seen The Irishman once.
Yeah.
So I don't remember like exactly the structure of it or, right. or everything.
Not
about
at
it.
Not at all the point, but I
generally, yeah, that's funny.
But it doesn't feel like
it
that.
It is a funny coincidence. But yeah, at least this one, definitely 3 hours and 14 minutes or so, barely felt like it. And it, I think it's very, you know, if you're not, if you can empathize with, you know, the victims of these horrific murders in the situation, I think it's pretty easy to stay engaged.
Yes.
You know, even as it's told from the perspective of the perpetrators, it's very, very easy to stay engaged. Everything on screen is compelling and, you know, you almost jaw dropping in how banal it is.
Right.
And the conversations that they're capable of having about these people and the acts that they're committing is just, it's near unbelievable. Like if it didn't really happen, you would think like it right. was a dramatization. I mean, in which this is, but they've taken things from actual transcripts. Like mm-hmm. we mentioned about that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that was ultimately my takeaway from the movie. It's like this movie just is depressing. It's deeply like again, if you empathize with the characters, which I hope everybody watching this can empathize with what's happening.
I wouldn't say I cried, but I was nearly moved to tears several times.
Yeah.
My eyes were welling up like
just had a knot in my stomach every time something would happen or every time you knew something was about to happen that
especially like when they, it's happening to me right now. Yeah. When they walk you through, how they killed Anna.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And and Henry Rowe
disregard for her like, as a person.
Yeah. And when they do Henry Rowe to, you know, the guy again, pretending to be his friend, like
so sad.
He spends about 3 weeks, like just getting to know this guy and having a great time with him. And then he just kills him. It's oh man,
the sequence where I forget that guy's name too, the guy that actually killed him.
Mm-hmm.
When they ask him to, he's like, "I'm not gonna kill anybody." And then they're like, "We're asking you to kill a Native American." And he's like, "Well, that's different, okay?"
Yeah,
and
like just it's John Ramsey.
Yeah, the absolute just disregard for humanity that these characters show again is so. So deeply depressing, and like I said, just sitting in that theater was just like a stone in your throat and your stomach because you just like the total complete disregard for any humanity in these like vibrant people is really heartbreaking, and it feels like a necessary story to be told, and you know there's been debate I guess about who should be telling that story too. I mean, obviously. We know who should be telling the story, but Martin Scorsese being the one to tell the story too, and doing it, I guess, to the best of his own abilities. But man, it just it is. I think it is very, very sad. And
you know,
and
I think in the hands of a white person, you know, Martin Scorsese are probably the best.
Right.
You know, he obviously took a lot of care, and all of the people who are Osage that were involved have said this at length.
Yeah, spoken highly.
That he, you know, really. Listened to their input and made sure at every step of the way that their concerns were heard and addressed. And you know, and again, going back to what I was saying earlier about there's almost no way you can walk away from this thinking that the main characters of the movie are the good people in this. Like
of course.
You know, it very much villainizes them, you know. because that's what they were
from the very start. Like, yeah, you can tell that these are again the wolves in the picture, to go back to what you're saying. So I mean, we've talked a lot about some different things in this movie. I guess just what did you think? Like, what was your overall takeaway from the film?
I mean, I think it's an important reminder of a history we like to forget about.
Right.
And just how callous and brutal it was. And I think, you know, a lot of in important conversations and hopefully some inspiration, mm-hmm. you know, to learn more about this history and to bring more light to it is the best thing we can hope for from something like this. And I think it achieves that, you know, is a step in the right direction, and hopefully you know, more Indigenous people will be able to tell their stories as a result of the success of this movie.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking the same thing along that line. Like, I think that this film itself is quite an achievement. And, you know, Martin Scorsese's made a lot of very important, impactful, very good films. And I think that this even feels a little different than some of those other similarly told stories, just because of the subject matter at hand, that it is so delicately pieced together. And I think that it's a very, very good movie. I think just watching it too, my thought was, you know, this is like Lily Gladstone is going to be a star coming from this, and she's going to be able to, you know, be a part of, I guess, like the cultural conversation, and more able to represent, you know, Indigenous culture and in future films and things like that. Hopefully this opens the door for more of these kinds of stories to be told, like you said. And I think that that in and of itself is amazing. But yeah, very good movie, a very well-made movie. Glad Taika Waititi didn't direct it.
Oh no.
For anybody who saw that conversation going around, but yeah.
Brutal.
Very, very much so. Do you want to round it up?
Four and a half.
I gave it four, but I've been thinking a lot about this movie since seeing it in the old IMAX. All right, Zach, we are going to talk about another movie that is also kind of a procedural about murder in a mm-hmm. sense in of a speaking. Sense, yeah. We're talking about Anatomy of a Fall. You want to describe what this movie is?
Yeah, so Anatomy of a Fall. It is about a woman. What is her name?
Her name is Sandra Voiter or something like that.
Yeah, that is right.
I think so. I'll throw out here right now, actually, just right off the top, that I actually wrote a whole review of this movie that is up on spinningthereel.com. It's been a while since I had one of those, so if anyone wants to read in depth after this too, I have that up there on the site. But yes, Sandra Voiter.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so this woman, Sandra, it is about. The entire movie is about a murder trial, but essentially what happens in leading up to the trial is a woman, Sandra, is the subject of an interview by a graduate student studying literature, because she's a famous novelist, mm-hmm. In which she writes about murders, you know, mystery right. books, essentially. And on this day of the interview, her husband is working in their chalet doing some renovations and playing very loud music, an instrumental of 50 Cent's PIMP. And then, which, you know, because he's being so loud and obnoxious, they end the interview and the woman leaves. And then later, their young son goes on a walk with their dog.
We should say the young son is like visually impaired. He can't.
Yes, yeah.
He has some vision, it looks like, but he can't.
Yeah, they say at some point that he lost almost all his vision, so he's not 100% blind, but he is essentially, you know,
right,
very, very heavily visually impaired. Takes the dog for a walk, and so it's just her and her husband in the house. And when the boy comes back, he finds his father dead, apparently having fallen from the balcony of the chalet to his death.
And then it becomes sort of a matter of, was this accidental? Did he do this to himself? Did his wife kill him? Because she was the only one that was home at the time that that he met his demise, I guess you could say.
Yeah, hence the title, An Anatomy of a Fall, or Anatomy of a Fall, in which the circumstances in which he fell are heavily, heavily analyzed.
Yes, and let's say right off the top, world-class dog performance in this movie.
Oh, my God.
The dog, his name is Snoop in the movie. He's played by a dog named Messi.
Snoop the dog.
Man, what a performance that dog gives throughout this movie.
Yikes.
Brutal. One of the most brutal things you'll see on screen happens to this dog at some point in the movie, so not for the faint of heart there. And I think it's really interesting because, like you said, you get this opening sequence where she's having this interview and it's interrupted by her husband. Never really see the husband. Actually, never see the husband.
Only in flashbacks.
Only in flashbacks and his body, of course. But, you know, it's kind of bearing over this whole event, this interview that's going on. And then, you know, once he's dead and they're trying to figure out what to do next, Sandra calls in her lawyer friend that she knew from some time back. There's an implication that maybe they were somehow involved or he would have liked to have been.
They were at school together or acquaintances, and he says explicitly like that he's been in love with her for a long time. So.
Right. And she has like no recollection of that time in her life or something like that. But anyway, so this guy comes in and just like, tell me everything you told the police. And she's trying to tell him like what happened, what her experience of things was, or at least her version of it. That's what's one of the interesting things about this movie is she's an author. And one of the first things she says in that interview is that she likes to blend fact with fiction. She likes to tell stories that have a grain of truth, but, you know, are, you know, fictionalized as well. And so it kind of sets the stage for she's talking to the lawyer and she's telling him, you know, about how she was feeling in certain points in this thing. And he's like, no, just tell me what you told them. Because, and I think he says it outright at some point, is like, it doesn't matter what happened.
Yeah.
It matters what people think happened. It matters what people think of you and like the perception that you're giving off to people.
Yeah.
And in that way, and I think,
That's basically a distillation of the central theme of the movie is like, in, I guess we can say at this point, like it's completely ambiguous whether she did it. Well, I say completely, but you know, the movie presents you with separate versions of what could have happened, and explicitly in the text tells you, you know, you have to choose what to believe.
Yeah, they literally give you a website before the movie starts that you can go vote whether you thought she did it or not.
Yeah, but I mean, from a thematic perspective and from a character perspective, you know, a character does say when we're unsure, you know, when we can't be certain of something and they seem equally plausible, then we have to choose.
Right. We have to tell ourselves something to keep living.
Yeah.
We have to decide.
To be able to move forward, especially in such a when the stakes are so high, whether, because this is the court-appointed sort of caretaker for Daniel, the son.
Yeah.
To make sure there's no undue influence on him and that he's okay, you know, throughout all this, because it's very traumatic. And a lot of things are come to light that he wasn't aware of about his parents and their sort of tumultuous relationship.
Right.
And he has a moment with the caretaker, and she gives him that advice, like, you know, if you're not certain, then you have to choose, like, and that's life.
Yeah, you have to make that, and that's the decision you have to live with. And it's very interesting the way, again, it's set up. It has all the trappings of a courtroom drama, in the, you know, way that, you know, it has all of those things. You know, it's got the lawyers presenting their cases. It's got the, you know, cross-examination and the questions from the judge and things like that. Like, it's got all of those things, but
testimony.
Exactly. Sort of like all of it. But what's so interesting is that it even sets up all of the proceedings as none of this really matters. Like, we're not on a mission to get to the truth. We're on a mission to get to, you know, some amount of understanding of what happened, and we can never be fully sure. and that it doesn't really even matter at the end of the day if she did it or if she didn't do it. What matters is that, like, because this movie, in the way that I think a lot of court movies tend to as well, it's not, like you said, it's not clear whether she did it or not, but much more than what happened is being put on trial here. You know, her relationship to her husband is being put on trial. Her, the care she gives to her son is being put on trial. You know, her demeanor, even just the way she presents herself in court, her nationality or culture is put on trial as well, because, you know, she is a German who has a preference to speak English in her home and is not very comfortable in French, but she's living here in France and this whole trial is taking place in French.
Right.
And having to kind of tailor who she is to be more likable. And it's a very interesting commentary on just the way that law is conducted in, specifically in this case in France, but it is universal in countries that run.
And honestly, you hit the nail on the head in saying that the trial is not really what the movie is about. I mean, a significant amount of the runtime is dedicated to the actual court proceedings. But yeah, what's on trial is not what happened. It's Sandra herself.
Right.
And, you know, people are making judgments and speculating and, you know, using her own written works against her and all of this, information and taking great liberties with her life, even though from her perspective, it's very much one section of it that, you know, it doesn't represent the whole picture.
Right.
And I mean, this is like we've seen this time and time again with high profile cases like, you know, Amber Heard and Johnny Depp just recently.
Right.
Like the trial is very much more about public opinion on a lot of times and how we can be influenced by what we perceive as opposed to what actually happened.
Right.
And yeah, it's the nature of the, the nature of the case is that all the evidence is circumstantial. So Sandra, again, tells her lawyer friend and the court and the police her idea or, you know, her experience of what happened. And then the police investigate and they try and determine, you know, how plausible is it that he jumped or fell,
right,
or was pushed or, you know, was bludgeoned and then fell. But there's no murder weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little forensic evidence because this happens in the winter and they're living in a ski chalet that they're intending to rent.
Right.
And so the way that the snow melts and runs off is like it moves the blood spatter and all this stuff that comes into play,
right,
for the trial. Which again, yeah, it's much more about our perception and how someone's entire life can be judged based on a very small dissection of a single day,
right?
You know, and maybe a few other days that are like supporting used in an attempt to support a conclusion that is either in the defense or the prosecution of this person.
Right. And just the way that they have to craft their argument specifically, I think it's interesting and gets at sort of the dichotomy between prosecution and defense in a way that is very interesting, because it is very, very two-sided in the way evidence is presented. Like for every expert witness that, you know, the prosecution brings in and the defense brings in their own blood spatter analyst, and you see like the prosecution expert is certain that there's no way this could be anything else.
Yeah.
And the defense is saying, well, you have to think about these things and this could be this or the other way. And it made me at least think about the way in which like this system is structured, not to necessarily, again, not to find the truth, but to get a conviction. And so, you know, once they've decided to charge Sandra, then it's not even about, you know, presenting what is a plausible theory, what is, you know, the truth or anything. It's just about saying, all right, we've decided this is how we are going to support this case in a way that I haven't seen too much. I was going to say one interesting, stick with me here, is the last movie I watched before this was The Burial. And I don't know if you've heard about The Burial.
I haven't seen it yet, but yeah, that's the Jamie Foxx.
Yeah,
right?
Jamie Foxx, Tommy Lee Jones. And this movie is made an interesting pair with it because it's also a courtroom drama about contract law. Basically, like Tommy Lee Jones enters into a contract with someone and the guy doesn't honor the contract. But this trial is taking place in the Deep South, and he brings in Jamie Foxx's character, Willie Gary, who is like this kind of like celebrity injury lawyer. Mm-hmm. And that movie is also very much about like how what you're trying to do is just convince a jury. You're trying to put on a show and paint one person as the hero and one person as the villain. And it actually did kind of, I thought, pair interestingly with Anatomy of a Fall, which is a far greater achievement of a movie. Anatomy of a Fall is like the filmmaking at work and the way that these events are portrayed and the tension is built up within it is on a different level, of course. But I think it's just interesting to see the way in which, you know, courtroom dramas have become less about, you know, like your, I mean, I don't know, To Kill a Mockingbird is actually a bad example because that movie is kind of about like perceptions as well.
Yeah.
But like how interested people are right now in seeing like, or telling these stories of the way in which the legal system is skewed in a certain way and can be manipulated. And yeah, I just think it's a very, very fascinating look at the system as much as it is the people.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting that especially in the course of the trial, like how even the most seemingly innocuous details can skew the narrative in a either direction. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I mentioned off the top that the song that he was playing that day is 50 Cent's P.I.M.P., right? Which the prosecution uses as an example to say that he was angry because Sandra had previously been, you know, with a woman, you know, in
right,
and had cheated on him, and that he was playing that song particularly because it's a misogynistic song and he was upset with her and, like, you know, was expressing that in a nonverbal way.
Also one of the funniest lines in the movie when the guy's it was an acoustic version.
Yeah, an instrumental. Yeah, that there's a lot of funny banter like that, yeah. Like when they're talking about the prosecution goes so far as to read some lines from one of her novels in which a character imagines her husband dead and how sort of freeing that would be. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the defense is like, okay, we need to provide the context to those lines. And it's like a minor character and this and that.
Right.
And then one of her lawyers says, you know, you can't take an author's words and say like that's who they are. You know, we don't say Stephen King is like a serial killer. And then the prosecutor's like, well, his wife didn't turn up dead under suspicious circumstances.
Right. The prosecutor is pretty funny.
He's asshole, but he is. Yeah, he's pretty funny. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good banter like that. But I think from a film like perspective, looking just like zooming out a little bit, it's not just the trial,
which is something this movie does a lot. A lot of good zoom work in this.
Definitely. But it's also a very, very densely layered drama. That's mm-hmm. kind of, you know, the trial is almost the black hole at the center and everything's kind of around its orbit. You know, it's just this force of gravity that everything is around, right. But the drama that's on the edges, you know, between her and her late husband and her son and just everything that's happened. And even her and her defense lawyer, like there's so many interesting moments on the edges of this that speak to some greater things and truths about relationships. Even as they're subject to, you know, surgical analysis, it's a very, very beautiful movie in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think one thing I'll point out as well is the score of the movie is very interesting in the way it accompanies what happens on screen. And so for context, the score of this movie is essentially her son Daniel is learning to play the piano, and he already has some basis of knowledge in it, but he's learning to play this song that is very, I don't even know how to describe it, but it does, there's like a darkness to it and mm-hmm. an intensity in the shifting of the notes. And at first it's uneven and there's a lot of missed notes, but as we start to get a clearer picture of what's happening, the sharpness of the piano really comes into tune. And I think it's a really interesting way to both say something about that character and the events going on screen, but then also providing just sort of like the perfect mood for what this movie is going for. And it's a real, one of the more interesting uses of a score that I've seen in a while in a movie.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think, you know, in terms of the technical craft of this, score, editing, cinematography, it's excellent, you know.
Yeah. Just, again, and it's interesting because I think this one is dealing with a pretty heavy subject matter too. Either murder or suicide is kind of what it comes down to.
Pretty much, at the end, yeah.
And that's pretty grim. But I think that there is some more levity to this movie as well, that it doesn't weigh you down quite so much. It really does feel like,
except for a brutal
that's, you know, true, very distressing scene involving Snoop that we alluded to,
which comes out of nowhere.
It does.
It's really just a punch in the gut,
very chilling moment. And yes, that is true. I will agree there. I don't know. Do you want to give any comment, or do you think she did it? I mean, I think the whole point of this movie is that it doesn't matter whether she did or not in the context of the story being told.
Yeah. But the case is not, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's unimportant, you know.
Yeah.
It's their lives and it's Daniel's mother, so like who he's in the care of after all of this. But, and we talked about this after, as we were walking out of the theater and on the drive back, but from my perspective, if we're to take the presentation of the movie literally, you know, just from what's shown in the courtroom and how it's portrayed, and there's particularly an argument that is the basis for the entire trial. The police find a recording, because Samuel, like his wife, who's a novelist, was also an aspiring novelist. He never actually published anything, while his wife is very accomplished. And it's, you know, very clear that there's some resentment because of that fact. Had begun recording moments from his life in preparation to write a novel, like some like an autobiographical thing, or something that he could later reference for some work of fiction, right?
Yeah.
So the police find this recording, and it's of a very tense argument that escalates and ends up in a physical altercation between the two of them. And it's sort of unclear exactly what happens, and they, you know, they're forced to speculate. But in the eyes of the law, that's what really pushes it over the edge of they're willing to indict her to take her to trial over this. And when we see that flashback, from my perspective, along with the evidence presented by the defense expert for the blood splatter, I think that she's innocent.
That's the conclusion I came to as well, as certain as one can be about it. I think the audio tape that you're talking about is such an interesting, it's positioned in a very interesting way in the film, because like you said, that is the piece that gets them to pursue a conviction against her. And I think, like you said, you watch it and you watch the way she comports herself and he does, and at worst for her, it's, they're both like equally kind of going at it to this degree, but it's presented in case. I mean, I agree. I think her position is obviously a more sound one. But it's presented in court as if she is the emotional one, as if she is the one who is initiating like the violence.
Well, she does like throw a wine glass or something. Like she, you know, that's the first sound you hear before it does become physical, and then there's no more words. It's just the sound of a struggle,
right?
I do think too that, you know, and this just goes to show the way that something, all someone has to do is ask the question, and you're immediately forced to think, oh, what about that? Yeah, or like, right, you know, essentially to reckon with it. And that's what lawyers do, is they just plant those sort of questions in your mind. But after they listen to the tape in court, the prosecution and the defense are sort of arguing about this, and then it comes out about him wanting to write this novel, and that's why he was recording his life, because the witness on the stand is the lead detective in the case, and he'd been reading his journal and listening to the audio recordings, and he was actually conferring with a friend about his plan, and that's how they knew the context for why he's recording stuff, and et cetera, right? But then the defense lawyer asks, like, we have to consider whether why he recorded this moment, you know,
did he provoke a fight?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Is it really a plausible coincidence that he would begin recording and then they would immediately start fighting. Like, you know, is that a natural occurrence, or did he, did he provoke it? And in that lens, if you look back, I think it's very clear that that's what happened.
Right.
That he, you know, I mean, from trying to empathize with him, I can totally understand the way he's feeling about his own life, but I absolutely agree with her that he's responsible for it.
Yeah.
And the choices that he's made, and the choices especially that he hasn't made, you know, the things he hasn't pursued. So, in my eyes, I think... I don't think she did it.
I just think it's interesting the way that, you know, and of course there's a few different lenses in which you can view that specific interaction and the way that it was perceived by, you know, the investigators and then, you know, the court of, you know, like you said, the defense lawyer brings that up. But, you know, in discussing it, the lead investigator is like, well, you can clearly hear that she is the one that is, you know, basically causing all of these things and doing all of these things. And, you know, there's this idea of like innocent until proven guilty, but she's on trial for this thing. So, you know, the inclination is to believe that she is the aggressor in this situation. And, you know, again, it just goes back to just pure misogyny as well, you know, thinking that certainly the woman in this situation is the one that's being emotional, even though, like, again, watching that, and I think maybe we both felt this way as well, is that, you know, you watch that sequence and it really is like him driving a lot of this stuff and his, you know, feelings of inadequacy and things like that, you know, and that she is being reasonable up until the point that he basically like questions her, her parenting, in that sequence. But I did think that was interesting the way that, it's presented in terms of like, you know, the perception of her as one, the defendant, and two, as a woman as well, is a subtext to this movie throughout as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's some things of note that are probably missing from our discussion about this, and that one, Sandra did cheat on him.
Yeah, multiple times.
And then also that the reason their son is visually impaired is because he got hit by a bicycle or by a car.
I think a car. When dad was supposed to have picked him up but was late or something like that.
Yeah, it's you know, implied that it's his dad's fault that the accident happened that caused his son to lose most of his vision, and there's a lot of guilt and blame and resentment surrounding that incident, and that's also, you know, brought up in the trial. But I think she rightfully calls him out on it in that, you know, he sort of checked out after that because of that, and then he uses that excuse along with her infidelity to, you know, sort of hamstring himself and say like, well, this is why I can't have a career. This is why I can't pursue what I want. And she's saying, no, please do that so you can like shut up already, you know, because I want you to be successful and I want you to have to like achieve your goals and all this stuff. But stop using me as like a crutch and pretending like I'm the one weighing you down when no one's in your way. Like you know, you made all these choices and all this stuff. And it's a very compelling argument. I think it's probably a common one, I would say, in relationships. And I think in my eyes, points towards her innocence.
Yeah. I think the last thought that I kind of had on the whole thing is there's a moment where she is sitting in a hotel room because they're going into like the last week of the trial and her son wants some space, and she's in a hotel room and she's watching like news coverage of the event. It's not even, it's more like entertainment news.
It's like Good Morning America.
Basically the equivalent of this. And the host,
or like The View.
Right. And the host of the show says something really interesting that I think sums up kind of the point of the movie pretty nicely. It puts a bow on it. And he says that it's much more interesting that an author killed her husband than a teacher committed suicide. And like just the narrative,
right?
The compellingness of the narrative is sort of what drives a lot of this too. And I think there's a lot of little things like that throughout the movie that just make you think like, are we being driven here by, you know, a sort of, I don't know, romanticized narrative of what like this kind of thing is? Versus what like is actually spelled out on screen. And I think this movie does a very interesting job, or a very good job, of laying out the facts as a jury would see them, but then also calling out the narrativization of, you know, trial and things like that. Do you have any like other last thoughts? Sandra Hüller is very good in this.
Yeah, I mean, from top to bottom, this is an excellent movie. Performances and all the technical stuff we've mentioned, very, very good. In my review verbatim, easy 5 stars.
Yeah. Well, let's round it up then. I did 4.5. Like I said, I wrote a whole review. It's on spinningthereel.com, so people should check that out if they're interested.
Yes, I mean, speaking of, just wrapping up here, we're trying to do some restructuring here and an overhaul to get back on schedule with our releases. So yeah, please look forward to that.
Yeah, we're gonna make some changes to the website and to the podcast here in the next few weeks and months to end out the year and start off the next year. But we'll have more to say about that going forward. All right, Zach, let's close things out. We just finished that last section talking about some changes that are coming to Spinning the Reel in the near future, and we'll have more to say about that. But in the meantime, where can people find us?
I'm on Letterboxd at painted_dog.
Yep, and I'm at EvanD26 on there, and also on Blue Sky now. A lot of movie posts going on over there.
Yeah, it's the Wild West over there.
That is so true.
And yeah, follow me on Letterboxd. I'm currently trying to do like a 31 movies in 31 days for this month. I'm at like 18 now, 17.
Got some catch up to do.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm not far trying behind. To do that, but yeah. I am still posting regularly on there. I'm actually trying to go back and make lists of all the different years so people can check that out. Like I said, I'm doing some updates to the Spinning the Reel website, but I am trying to get back on track for reviews there. Anatomy of the Fall is the most recent one. I also have a fairly recent review of Landscape with Invisible Hand up on there. Going to AFI Fest.
This weekend.
Yeah, this weekend. And so look for some reviews out of there as well.
Any last words?
Just classic goodbye.
Bye.